Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and for this show, I'm joined by a fascinating pair, the director and star of The Counterfeiters, a brilliant concentration camp film about forged Nazi banknotes. I also look forward to the London Film Festival, which starts next week, and interview one of the names to watch, former LFF-winning director Asif Kapadia. But let's start with one of the most remarkable World War II stories ever told on film. Based on what I'm told are real-life events, The Counterfeiters is the tale of Jewish forger Salomon Sorovich, arrested in the Berlin underground and interned at Mauthausen concentration camp. Whilst there, his reputation as the King of the Forgers, or Der König der Fälscher, singles him out for special treatment. The Nazis have a plan to use Salomon to create millions of false sterling and dollar banknotes to flood the international money markets and scupper the Allies' economy. The film thus becomes a moral tug of war for Salomon. Does he rise to the great test for any forger and create notes that will fool even the most fastidious of Swiss bankers? Does he therefore help the Nazis win the war, or does he throw a spanner in the printing works? Sally, as is known, is given a team of Jewish bank workers, printers and forgers, all arrested in the concentration camp and in turn given cushy billets in the camp, bigger beds, recreation rooms, music even. In short, they're asked to collaborate to survive, so the fakes in question aren't just fake banknotes, but whether these men and Sally, the forger-in-chief, are being true Jews, true humans at all in the face of the greatest act of inhumanity of the 20th century. I met up with The Counterfeiters' Austrian director, Stefan Rozovitsky, and the lead actor, Karl Markovic, who gives a memorably haunted performance as the conflicted Salomon. I found him on considerably better form than his emaciated character in the concentration camp. Congratulations, Karl, first of all. It's lovely to see you with different glasses. You look a lot sort of better fed now than in the film.
Yes, often it depends if I'm working very hard or not. At the moment, I'm not working very hard, so I have some kilos more. And at the movies, I had less because I had a lot of energy to put in, of course, and
It's a wonderful performance in the film. We'll come back to you in a minute, Karl, because I wanted to talk to Stefan first about the discovery of this story, because part of the joy of this film, I think, is finding, certainly for British viewers or American viewers, a side of war films, a genre of movie, if you like, that has never been explored before. And I think it's probably the same for German-speaking audiences.
Yes, I mean, this story isn't widely known, or I don't know anybody who had heard about it before. Some years ago, it was necessary to tell people the basics of the Holocaust and the Nazis with a series like Holocaust or also Schindler's List, which is sort of very encyclopedic about the beginning anti-Semitism, the ghetto in Warsaw, the first camps, and the final solution in Auschwitz. And you don't have to do this anymore. You can also try to this pass pro toto, you can say that in English as well. Yeah. Show one aspect which helps you to say something fundamental about the big picture, which we try to do with this story here.
I think we're going from large-scale inhumanity, where you sort of say that on the basic level, oh, this was a terrible thing, to the actual very human stories that are kind of woven into the fabric of history, the kind of the little bits that we might have missed.
And I think this story, people haven't been talking a lot about it, because if you want to teach people or school kids about the Holocaust, you won't start with the counterfeiters who were living under these very privileged circumstances. You know, so this is the worst example to tell people what a concentration camp is about. But still, for a movie, I think it works very well because what you can do here, which is always very effective, you don't have to show everything, and it's the audience that sort of completes what's missing and what we don't show.
Given that it's a film in a way that deals with truth and lies on very different levels, can you assure us that this story is actually true rather than a fake?
Yes, it is. Of course, it's a feature film and not a documentary, and we made some adjustments, and so we changed the names of all the people who weren't still alive, yeah. And I couldn't agree that their names would be used, but especially all these bizarre details. You couldn't make that up. You couldn't make up that there's a ping pong table in a concentration camp, and that they're having operetta music played to the inmates all day long to motivate them in the musical evenings. And the guy who's in charge of this counterfeiting operation used to be the head of the anti-counterfeiting squad, mm-hmm. at the German police before the war. And all this is again too bizarre to be made up. Mm.
It's ultimately, obviously, a story of survival and what one will do to survive, and portrayed brilliantly that dilemma, a moral dilemma for you, Carl, mm-hmm. because your character, in another film, your character would be the villain,
yes.
but in this film, he's a hero, so it's all about shades of, I suppose, evil.
Right, and that was the reason why this character interested me so much when I first read the book. The script, and I always like characters not going one straight line, but have different possibilities and different shadow and light. Of course, all good and evil is all put together in one human being. There is no hero, no good and no bad. There is all together, and yes.
And when we see your character in the first bit of the film, this rather glamorous Côte d'Azur, Monaco, he has a robotic kind of approach to life, and you don't know how to read this man. Is he a proud man? Is he a sad man? Is he a hollow man?
Yes, there is a secret. There is a mystery behind this guy, and this shall make, of course, audience curious. What is his story? And even if they might don't like them, him at the first, but they are curious, and they want to know at least why they might don't like them, mm-hmm. him, and they have no other chance to see this story. Ooh. Without going together with him.
I mean, looking at you now, your eyes are kind of, you know, bright and blue, and you're smiling, and you have a little glint of mischief in your eye. I mean, that makes it even better performance, because what you manage in your performance is to make the eyes dead.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
I don't think that I make my eyes dead, but I try to create a character. This guy always was trained himself not to show anything, because he was always afraid to get arrested or somebody would talk to the police, and so he always had to check out other persons and not letting them know what he is. So this is a trained way of not showing anything.
Remind me never to play poker with you. That's an interesting combination of a Cincinnati Kid with a Holocaust, yes, movie, the Western, yes. But in a way, the characters are kept in the camp. There's a very sort of pioneering. There is a kind of Western spirit to it in a way, because they're doing an illegal operation. They're bootleggers, aren't they? Really.
Yes, I mean, this was sort of the aspect when I first heard about the story and didn't know about any detail. Just this pitch, a counterfeiter in a concentration camp, is sort of striking. And you think, well, you know right away there are opportunities. How far can you forge things there? Can you betray yourself being in a concentration camp? Or is a concentration camp too big in every respect that you can look away or betray yourself or betray anybody else? And so this made much sense to me right away, and to sort of work with these elements.
Did you look at the history, the mechanics of a concentration camp, how they work, and which ones did you look at in particular?
Sure, I did. I read a lot of all these autobiographies that we know of, and sort of the interesting things. One is that the system was structured in a way that the inmates would torture and kill each other. Oh. You know, with this capo system and sort of the SS soldiers not only but watching, but you know, with putting a few inmates on top of the others and giving them ultimate power about life and death, they would use that, and so the system was cynical and cruel to its core. And in many autobiographies, people will say that the situation in the concentration camp didn't bring out the best in men, but just the opposite. Show your bad sides. This was, you know, part of the system. You can't blame these people for that, but they blame themselves. And this is why this whole complex of survivor's guilt was so important to me, or why I was so interested in that.
And I think you portray that rather brilliantly as well. It's the layers of of the film that make it so interesting. I wondered also what about in real life survivors. I've met quite a few Holocaust survivors, but they tend to be more Jewish victims who have displayed strength. I don't know in Austria or in Germany where there are people who survive who were, of course, not the victims, but who were actually the in charge. And whether they're part of society, and that you were thinking about them when you make the film, almost from the other side.
From the other side, talking about Nazis, or
yes.
It's not really, because they wouldn't talk about their past. I mean, I just can tell about my own family, and as much as I know, all my grandparents more or less were followers of the Nazi Party. I mean, not in a way that I'm traumatized because they've been some major war criminals, but you know, they just were fascinated by all that, and some were party members. One grandfather applied for, but at that time they wouldn't accept any more members because almost everybody was a member of the Nazi Party anyhow, and my grandparents wouldn't discuss it. You know, it's. I can remember my grandmother, and as soon as somebody would start, you know, within the family about the Nazi era, not about her, but just about that time, she would leave the room and say, "You have no idea what it was like back then."
Well, it's amazing now that we've all survived, thank God, to tell these stories, and that your film tells a story that I think, obviously, it's a wonderful film story, but it's also a human story that probably kind of gives us a bit more of a picture and fills us in. So congratulations on that, Stefan, and
thanks,
Carl, on your performance. Ausgezeichnet, as they say.
Thanks.
Director Stefan Rozovitsky and actor Karl Markovich, the talents behind the memorable Counterfeiters. Now, the 51st London Film Festival gets underway next Wednesday, the 17th of October, kicking off with David Cronenberg's London-set Russian underworld film Eastern Promises, and ending 16 days and 182 feature films later with Wes Anderson's The Darjeeling Limited. In between, there are all manner of galas and events, red carpets and parties, celebs and unknowns, new stuff and classics, with appearances from Deep Breath, Halle Berry, Todd Haynes, Ben Whishaw, Sean Penn, Ang Lee and his newcomer Tang Wei. Romania's Christian Mungiu will introduce actress Anna Maria Marinka and his Cannes-winning film 4 Months, 3 Weeks, 2 Days. Naomi Watts is in two movies, the Cronenberg film and Funny Games, Michael Haneke's remake of his own film. While at the Odeon Leicester Square, Tom Cruise, Meryl Streep and Robert Redford will probably be the highest-powered lineup at the world premiere of Lions for Lambs. There'll be John Cusack, Amy Adams, Laura Linney, Steve Buscemi, and in the weirdest combination probably ever, David Lynch and Donovan host what's billed here as a unique evening discussing meditation, consciousness and creativity. Well, amid all that, contemporary British talent is, I feel, a little thin on the ground, although Paul Greengrass will be being honoured with a Variety achievement and giving an on-stage talk, and a director called Asif Kapadia will certainly be there. His film on the square, Far North, should be a talking point and a popular event. I met up with Asif at Venice last month to discuss his film, which sees him return to the LFF, where his striking debut, The Warrior, won the Sutherland Award for first-time directors 6 years ago. Far North is a mythical, zen-like fable set on the Arctic ice, telling of Michelle Yeoh's inscrutable, protective mother and her love for her daughter when their icy existence in yurts is shattered by the arrival of a stranger, played by, strangely, Sean Bean. It's a film of great beauty and also great violence, building to a real coup de cinema as the finale, which, if Asif's done it right, should leave audiences stunned.
This idea came up. A short story was given to me by my co-writer, Tim Miller, and he gave me this 5-page short story by Sarah Maitland. And it was just about two women, an older woman and a younger woman, who live on the ice. And it's what happens when they find a man on the ice and have a simple decision: leave him, let him die, or save him, bring him home. And it leads to an awful tragedy. And I just thought, this is going to be easy. It's three people in a tent in one location. What could go wrong? This will be a quickie. I'll knock this one out and then do something more complicated for my next film. And yeah, here we are 6 years later, just having finished it. Nothing is simple.
No, but I think it's a beautiful, beautiful film. But rather like the yurt in which much of it's set, there's kind of a lot of intricate patterns involved in it. I thought it was amazing to see a film that actually kind of kills animals. It kills seals and reindeer and wolves. It's kind of like, it reminded me of my old geography exercise book from my old school. They hadn't replaced the books from the 50s, rather than a kind of sensitive eco doc.
I mean, where we were, I mean, the indigenous people that we had in the film and who we worked with, this is their life, this is how they live. And what's amazing, it's like 4 hours north of London, there are people who herd reindeers and who migrate all the year round with their animals. And so we worked with them in the film, and everything that we have in the film came from them. And so, you know, that's what they live off of. They have reindeer, that's what they eat. And so, you know, for example, when there's a seal in the film in Svalbard, the island we were filming on, the husky dogs are fed seal meat, and so they hunt seals, and they the seals are all used. The skins are used, the bones or whatever animals we have, the reindeer bones are all used. And so in this case, we borrowed a seal, which was already dead, and it's all off camera, the killing. But we took the seal, used it for the shot, and then it went back to the husky dogs that live there and work there.
But it's fairly refreshing, I must say, because I mean, many filmmakers would sort of say, oh no, we must protect the animals, we must protect the ice flow. Yours was really about, actually, there's people that live here, and for centuries they've been doing it this way.
It's set in a real place with real people and very, very harsh landscape. And I think what was important for the film was to show the harshness of these people's survival of what they can kill. You know, their animals give them their food, they give them heat, you know, use blubber lamps, which come from the animals. The clothes are made from the animals, the homes are made from the animals, their transports come from the animals. And without the animals, they would die. And without each other, they can't hunt. And I think that was a very important part, to show that world and to show some of the gruesome sides of life. And so that when we get to the ending, we understand that this is a really harsh world and people are desperate and they will do desperate things to survive.
That does set up the ending. You mentioned the ending, which you can't see your film and not sort of... I mean, I loved the film before we got to the ending anyway. Then the ending happens. It's such a shock. It's a coup de cinema in a way, but it's one, as a critic, and presumably as you as the filmmaker, we can't reveal, we can't really talk about it. I mean, was that always going to be a problem as a storyteller?
No, I wouldn't call it a problem. It was always something that excited me. It was in the original short story, and it's the thing that made my jaw drop when I read it. I just thought, I mean, you know, you read something, you think something awful is going to happen, but you don't expect this. And so, yeah, as much as possible, I'd love to try to protect that. But for me, the challenge as a filmmaker was to make a film where I wanted to try to make a film that had the same power that I felt when I read a short story. And in a way, it was a shock, but also it almost made perfect sense because I had a feeling it could lead to something like this. But even then, it just took you out. It blew my mind when I read the short story. And so the challenge is always, over these years, when writing the script and making the film and cutting the film and doing the sound, was to say, how can we build up to this event so that we have this powerful ending and then leave the audience? And hopefully, you know, the idea is for this film and this moment to stay in the audience's head once they've left the cinema and walk out into the daylight. And that's always what excited me.
To be honest, I don't really know when this film is set.
Yeah, I'm interested by the idea of creating a universe that's specific to the film. So even though the film was shot in Norway and on this island Svalbard near the North Pole, really we're creating a mythical North, and they're running away from people who are encroaching from the South. And, you know, it's really a meeting of cultures, you know, the kind of modernity and people from the West are coming in, and the indigenous people's land is being squashed and squashed. And I suppose there was somewhere underneath there, I like the idea of, you know, what happens to indigenous people is when everything's taken away from them, often they can start harming themselves and start, you know, abusing themselves. And I think there was something underneath the surface that was interesting in showing in that way.
Just tell me a bit about the casting of Michelle Yeoh, which a lot of people would say, well, you know, she was in, last time we saw her, she was like, you know, she's been a Bond girl and Crouching Tiger and Hidden Dragon. She's Chinese, of course. Why is she in Norway?
I always knew that the two women, I wanted them to have a kind of an Inuit look, but all the Nanette people in Russia have a very Asian look to them. And so that was a given. And the two women had to both come from that background. And I was working with a casting director, Avi Kaufman, who's done all of Ang Lee's films, as well as, you know, people like Lars von Trier. And she'd worked with Michelle on Crouching Tiger. And because I wanted someone, a brilliant actor, but I also wanted someone that who's going to go through this journey with us. And she just told me how wonderful Michelle was and what an amazing person. So we sent her the script. She liked the script. We met in Sundance about 3 years ago. And we just got along. And subsequently, she said to me, she chooses a film depending on who the director is and whether they get along or not, and she's got to decide, okay, I'm going to go with it. And, you know, she had to wait for us for quite a few years, and there were huge movies, studio films sitting there waiting for her to do it, and she kept saying, no, I really want to do this film. And we had a very specific window. We could only shoot it within like 3 or 4 weeks in the autumn to go up into the Arctic to shoot in the most extreme location. And she put aside other films to make sure this happened. So she was our fairy godmother. On the shoot, when we were on our Russian icebreaker, we all lived on a ship while we were shooting, her partner was sending food up. She organised, you know, we were getting lovely food from Italy sent up to the Arctic. And in the end, Jean Todt, her partner, brought a chef up as well. So it was just amazing. She really looked after everyone. So she's fantastic to work with, fantastic in the camera, but she's a very great person as well.
And she's a big star. I mean, we forget how quite a big a star she is, actually.
She's huge. And you know, when you come to somewhere like here, and what's amazing to see Michelle when she's, you know, going to a premiere or to a gala screening, and the photographers and the journalists and everyone's going crazy. And then when you suddenly see her in the film, that contrast is pretty amazing. You know, she's an amazing jet setter. She travels the world constantly. She's never in the same city over a couple of days. And yet somehow she can sit down with you and just concentrate on the work.
People might be surprised that Sean Bean pops up. I mean, I saw that it's far north with Sean Bean. I thought Sheffield, maybe. It's a lot further north than that.
Yeah, it's north of Watford. It's interesting because, you know, I had these two women, two Michelles, and I needed the right guy. I needed the right guy that kind of you could believe that could be out in this place and strong enough to deal with the place. But also, because there's very little dialogue in this film, it's also to do with having the right interesting face that you can just, the camera's going to have all this detail coming out. And Sean was great. I mean, it's very difficult, the kind of casting process. I met Sean once in London. I met quite a lot of actors in London and in the States and in Europe. And then we didn't meet again. And I ended up casting him over the phone. I was in Kentish Town in a Ethiopian restaurant. The phone finally rings. I've been waiting for Sean to get back to me after he'd read the script, and finally it rings. I stand in the car park, he's in New Mexico, and we do the casting over the phone. And in the end, we didn't get the actors together until we were actually up in the Arctic. And you just have to trust your gut and hope that the two girls are going to work together and be similar enough and different enough, and then for Sean to be the right kind of, to form the correct triangle. And those dynamics are very hard because you just can't get people together when one of them's in Asia, one's in LA, and one's in New Mexico.
I thought he had it was quite a revelation performance from Sean, because I just thought, God, he's going to get a lot of Westerns out of this, because he looked like a good old cowboy who survived, you know, all sorts of kind of, you know, elements and endeavours.
Absolutely. For me, you know, just looking at the people's faces becomes a big part of when I'm casting. I just want to know, you know, can I just hold a shot on them and a close-up? And Sean definitely has that. And what was interesting, just that edge of, you're not totally sure, do I trust this guy? Is he believable or not? And there was just something uneasy about it, which I wanted for the character to have, which I think he brings out very well. And, you know, it was on day two of the shoot, I think, when we had him. The snow came in without us hoping. You know, we weren't expecting it. We had to shoot the end of the film, right at the beginning of the shoot, which meant something very cold. Sean had to do something very extreme, and he just did it. And I said, okay, that's great, let's do it again. And he just went with it.
It's a brave performance, particularly that moment. It seems like an amazing sort of thing to want to go and do, and park yourself in the Arctic for that long. I mean, I don't like saying one suffers for one's art, as if, but you must have suffered a bit. It's a bit chilly.
It was very cold. But what the Norwegian saying is, there's no such thing as bad weather, just bad clothes. So once you go up there and you get used to it and you know what you're dealing with, I have felt colder in South London than I felt up in the Arctic, because you've got to be wearing the right kit and you just got to know how to deal with it. You've got to eat properly. And so it was very challenging, and quite a few crew fell ill. There were a few people who kind of fainted out of exhaustion. But it's the kind of place that will stay with you for the rest of your life, and it haunts you. You know, you can be driving down the road in Santa Monica, and you just think, I'd love to be up in the ice.
Asif Kapadia there, and his film Far North screens at the Odeon West End as part of the LFF on October the 30th, as well as in his home turf of Hackney at the Rich Mix Centre, a new venue this year, on October the 31st. That's on Bethnal Green Road. For all your LFF info, tickets, screening times, bookings, screen talks and all that sort of stuff, go to www.lff.org.uk, or you can even ring 0044 207 928 3232. That's 207 928 3232. How international of us to include those dialing codes for you. And Film Weekly and The Observer will of course be keeping you up to date with podcasts, interviews and reviews from the London Film Festival. Still, there's plenty on at the cinemas outside of the LFF. This week sees the arrival of the beautifulest animation ever made, Ratatouille, or Ratatouille, a quite stunning-looking cartoon about a rat who makes good in a Paris kitchen. It looks absolutely ravishing, this film, with its textures and colours. The fur and the water on a drowned rat have never been so stylishly rendered. And there are dazzling sequences throughout, following Remy the rat as he scuttles from one scrape to another through sewers and floorboards until he finally ends up at Gusteau's fading gastronomic empire in the heart of Paris. There, this Pixar film, directed by The Incredibles' Brad Bird, takes flight in one of the best cartoon bits I can remember. It's the sort of thing you'd get repeated on those cartoon cavalcade compilation shows I used to love, like the Bedknobs and Broomsticks football match, or those Siamese cats chasing and Lady and the Tramp, or that virtuoso Tom and Jerry concert piano sequence. Remy is swooped around the kitchen on trolleys, through colanders, into sauces, sliding up spoons and gravy boats and around bowls, into vegetables and cheeses and in and out the ovens and dodging flames and whisks and chopping knives. This is a film all about wondrous details, the fluffiness of a baguette, the wire gauze of a chef's hat. The problem is that while foodies and adults may marvel at it, I didn't think it was very funny. I smiled a lot, but there were no actual laughs in the screening I attended. Nothing was stirring. As the old cartoons used to say, nothing, not even a mouse. However, there were some nods of approval, I note, for the sneering critic, Anton Ego, voiced with great relish by Peter O'Toole. Now for a withering rundown of the rest of the week's releases. The biggest is probably The Invasion, starring Nicole Kidman and Daniel Craig, a remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, made by Downfall director Oliver Hirschbiegel. Surely it must work. Apparently it's so bad that Warner Brothers didn't give us a press preview, so I haven't seen it. Poor Nicole Kidman. She hasn't had a hit for years, maybe since Moulin Rouge and the others. Bewitched, Stepford Wives, The Human Stain, Birth, Dogville, The Interpreter and Fur, in which I thought she was actually rather good, but no one went to see these at all. She wore that funny nose once, won an Oscar for it, and now nobody cares. It's really weird. Not as weird as Mr. Brooks, however, a new film with Kevin Costner as a well-to-do serial killer. It looks good for about 30 minutes when William Hurt turns up as his alter ego, egging him on to murderous sprees, but then it becomes quite ridiculous and Demi Moore shows up wearing a vest as a cop. Black Sheep is a bit of a giggle from New Zealand writer and director Jonathan King, a woolly story of genetic engineering gone bad as killer zombie sheep overtake a farm. The band of survivors defend themselves with a rifle and some shears. I thought, hey, it's this year's Shaun of the Dead. Ha ha, I kill me, I really do. More zombies in Resident Evil, Extinction, the third in the series based on a computer game. Mila Jovovich leaps about a post-apocalyptic world where humans have been wiped out by a virus, and a group of men, mainly with posh English accents and led by Ian Glenn's evil scientist, run things from an underground lair that looks like a Schrager hotel. Despite the zombie chaos above, there are some Mad Max-style survivors driving around the desert trying not to get bitten, while Miller still feels no need to put on a pair of trousers. Oh, and why is it in zombie films that there's always one bloke who's bitten early on by the zombies and he stays with the group, occasionally looks at his wound, like furtively under his shirt, and hides it from his chums until he becomes infected at a crucial moment? Answers on a zombie email? No, not really. That's about it for Film Weekly this week. This show was produced by Paul Noble. I've been Jason Solomons, and in the manner of Rolf Harris's cartoon time, let's go out to a nice bit of Ratatouille. Happy viewing.
Just once in a lifetime.
Let's do this thing!
Man knows a moment.
You gotta taste this!
You detect that? An oaky nuttiness?
Oh, I'm detecting nuttiness.
We hate to be rude, but we're friends.
I have a secret. I have a rash.
You have a rash?
He's toying with my mind, taunting me with that rash.
As though I had wings.
Come on, it's getting away!
Together, we can be the greatest chef in Paris.